This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome to another Star Groven episode of Junk Food Cinema here on FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Star Grove.
Yeah, get ready for that to be a fucking running theme through this episode, folks. This is the cult and exploitation film cast so good, it just has to be fattening. I'm Brian, he's Cargill. Lieutenant, how goes your day?
It's going kind of awesome, actually.
Yeah?
I'm watching movies and playing Pokemon. I mean, that's... How could it not?
And now we're going to check in with 10-year-old Cargill. Cargill from several years ago.
I love who I grew up to be, and that's all he has to say.
You're like someone who got caught in the middle doing a Life cereal commercial. Like, the kid in me likes this, and the adult, and like some weird Cronenberg thing happens, and you just can't transition all the way back.
I'm the guy that if I traveled back in time to meet myself, would get a high five from most of the incarnations of me.
Yeah.
At various times. They're like, wait, so you read comic books, you play video games, you watch movies, and people pay you for that kind of stuff? Like, that's what you do? It's like, yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
So, I'm watching movies and playing Pokemon. And
yeah.
Just, you know, like most other people are doing, you know.
So, this Pokemon thing, I've caught several necklaces from the early 2000s that nobody wears anymore. But I think I downloaded. Shells. Yeah, I think I downloaded the wrong app because
I think you did.
Okay.
And lots
of invites to Sum 41 concerts, but
yeah,
no,
you also need to get rid of the Pearl Necklace app that you have.
I kind of like that one actually, but that's because I have talks with younger me, and that's really the only common ground we still have. So good job, young Brian.
Star Grove.
If you would like to hear more musings like this, definitely check out our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, or on Twitter @junkfoodcinema. Quick Patreon update. We dropped below the 200 episode limit, which is fine. It happens. Pledges fluctuate. That totally makes sense. So we are going to, once that comes back up, we're going to do our first episode of JFC a la mode, which I'm really excited about. So definitely, if you haven't already pledged and you have a couple shekels to throw into the hat, please consider doing that. Or if you can't, or if you've already done so and still want to help out, just spread the word as much as humanly possible. Maybe tell people that we are trying to put together a Life cereal commercial directed by David Cronenberg, because now I think that's my personal mission in life, and I am going to be on top of that. Well, now, my little turd balls, my little scum buckets, we have one hell of a show for you today, don't we, Kirk?
One hell of a weird show. Like, of all the films that came out in the summer of 86, this is by far...
This is one of them.
The strangest.
Oh, yes.
This is... what you're about to hear about, you probably have never heard of this movie. This is a movie that most people, you know, here in our scene hadn't heard of until someone dug up one of the surviving 35mm prints and started showing it at the Draft House every once in a while. It's a movie that's like Cobra and If Looks Could Kill, starring Richard Grieco, had a child that had extra chromosomes.
Yes.
That's what this thing would be. Like, it is a movie that could only exist in the 80s.
If it had both chromosomes and two sets of genitalia, as it turns out.
And is also highly insensitive.
Oh, so insensitive.
And really over the top and playing upon a bunch of tropes that don't actually go together, creating one meaty stew of a fucked up, stupid, gloriously awful movie.
All of these things are true.
All of the, like, it's like none of these things, like, there are things in this movie that you're like, why am I watching a George Lazenby spy movie with road warrior idiots on drugs and a hermaphroditic rock and roll cast off? Like, what the fuck am I watching?
The reason that you're watching that is because the universe loves you and wants you to be happy.
Yeah.
Or at least that's how I'm looking at it for sure.
No, and that's just the tip of the iceberg of just what gets thrown into this gumbo, man. Like, this is by far the strangest thing that we have watched.
Oh, milestone. Level up.
And yeah, and just on top of that, it's one of those movies that you watch that you can't entirely tell if it takes itself seriously or not. Like, this is a movie, like when we were talking earlier, it reminds me of Torque and I Know Who Killed Me, in that it feels like a movie that the studio thought was serious, but the director didn't. And then went and made exactly the movie they asked for, but made it so weird that you can't possibly take it seriously. And if you watch it in the right mindset, it's freaking hilarious.
Yes.
And that's what this feels like. This feels like a movie that they were just like, you're kidding me. Like, we're making a teenage spy movie with a hermaphroditic villain trying to dump radioactive waste into the wastewater. And you want me to take that seriously? No, I refuse. Because there's elements in here that are either too stupid to have been done by a human being, that shouldn't be ashamed of themselves, or are deliberately over the top and kind of winking at the camera without actually turning and winking. It's very, like, we'll get into all the various things, but the biggest thing that just melted my brain was every time they talk about computers in this movie.
Sure.
Like, every time they talk about computers, they get it so unbelievably wrong. It's like somebody flipped through a book and took a bunch of terms out.
Yeah.
And just because they're looking for a disc. That's the MacGuffin of this movie. They should have just called it the MacGuffin, but it's the disc. They need the disc. The disc has information and codes on it in order to pull off their evil plot. And...
or whatever.
They keep asking everybody, where's the disc? Where's the RAM K? Where's the RAM K? We need the RAM K. And it's like, RAM K? What... And then you get to the end, and the end of the movie where they've got, you know, the briefcase, and he's like, deprogram it. No, don't you know anything about computers? Once you program it, you can't deprogram it. Like, wait, what?
Watching you do the fittingly mental gymnastics of trying to wrap your head around this movie is such a joy for me. I'm just like, yes. Yes, uh-huh. All of these things are correct.
All of these things are true. All of these things are like, why? What?
You have adequately downloaded this movie into your mental RAM K.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is one of those movies I wish I'd had on video in the early 90s as one of those, you're not going to believe that this is a thing.
Like, yeah.
Have you ever seen this John Stamos movie?
As opposed to all those other John Stamos movies?
Oh, there were a couple John Stamos movies.
Well, because of this one, there aren't many. This is the movie that was supposed to be the launching pad for John Stamos' film career. You know, as we're moving through One Junkie Summer, our exploration of the junkiest movies of 1986, this is a little more serious. It's an intense contemplation on the aging process and what it means to have a finite amount of time on this planet, because this week we're talking about John Stamos in Never Too Young to Die.
The new American hero. John Stamos is Stargrove.
Stargrove!
Vanity is Donja. Gene Simmons is Ragnar.
Yeah!
Never Too Young to Die, rated R.
So, Never Too Young to Die, as Cargill mentioned, is a teen spy film where essentially we have Stargrove! Who is...
Well, let's... Before we get into the plot...
Before Stargrove. Pre-Stargrove.
No. Before we get into the plot, in order to understand exactly what you're getting into, this is a movie that has a theme song about its main character.
Well, I'm going to play a little bit right now. For the rest of the show, expect to hear that.
Yeah. When you have, it's not just, it's not just that it's a theme song about the character.
Sure.
It's just how bad and lazy a theme song it is.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's one of those that it's like, wow, it's the, what are we doing? We're making a movie called Never Too Young to Die. Well, that already sounds like it should be a Springsteen song. So
we're never too young to die.
So
even if we're just dying.
What's the character's name? Stargrove. Stargrove? Stargrove. Oh, we just wrote the song.
And done. I got a huge bag of cocaine that is not going to snort itself.
While this terrible song is playing, you're treated to a montage of John Stamos jumping on a trampoline. And that's it.
Yep.
The entirety of the song, it's a full-length song, jumping on a trampoline.
Yeah, it is gymnastics as a montage.
Yeah,
it is a gymnastics montage, which I thought you would appreciate being such a big fan of Can't Stop the Music. But I guess without...
And Gymkhana.
Yeah, well, there you go. Sure, sure.
No. But the thing is... He doesn't do any other gymnastics. Like we're supposed to get the impression that he's a gymnastic expert. And so you'd think in a montage like this, you'd see him doing 12 different types of gymnastics and be like, ah, he's a gymnast. I get this. This is why he will end up being a wonderful super spy by the end of the movie. But no, it's just that John Stamos training, on a trampoline.
Yeah, which means he has all of the athletic prowess of a drunk girl at a party in the South because he just jumps on a trampoline. That's it. That's all he does. And you would think that those gymnastic skills would maybe come in play later, and like that's why secretly he's a great agent.
They
and
do occasionally.
Ish. Like, yeah, in very, very meager ways. But yeah, okay. So yeah, we start on gymnastics. That's where we're starting, folks. Actually, it begins. The movie actually begins at a I'm going to call it a Ragnar rally, because Ragnar, our villain slash villainess, is
our titular.
Whoa, appropriate word. Our villain-ish. I'm not even sure. I want to be sensitive and identify this villain by the appropriate article, but because it is established that Ragnar is hermaphroditic. So at various points through the movie, Velvet von Ragnar, by the way, is the full name, and at various points is just dressed. It's Gene Simmons from the band Kiss, dressed in less than sensitive, it's basically Kiss in lingerie throughout the entirety of this movie, which is a choice that was made. This movie,
it was an acting. It was a big choice.
Yeah,
and the acting that goes along with it is so insensitive and over the top. Like, especially when you who Gene Simmons has kind of become over the last 20 years, it makes total sense what he's doing. But
sure,
it's bizarre that he even chose to do it. Like, it is wow. Like, wow. He commits. And see, you call it the Ragnar Rally. It really is kind of like the scenes from Cobra.
Yes, with the Army of Maniacs.
Mixed with
Road Warrior.
Similar scenes from Dragnet.
Oh, wow. Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, put your drinks down for just a second. Someone on the internet just referenced the Dragnet movie. Get a bulletin out there, all points, because the internet may explode and not be there tomorrow because someone actually referenced the Dragnet movie. Well done, Cargill.
The Virgin County Swale?
I did not see that coming. Done.
How do you not? Like that? It is very. These are movies about terrible cults that make no fucking sense whatsoever. Like this Ragnar's Road Warrior cult.
Or the small cult of fans of Never Too Young to Die. I'm starting to see the connection here.
Like
sure,
they all dress like the Road Warriors. Everyone has an IQ of 60.
Sure, if that.
They inexplicably walk around with weapons they never really use. When the good guys do something bad, they just kind of stand there and gape at the hero until the hero shoots them.
I bet since this came out a year after Thunderdome, I bet those Road Warrior costumes were real easy to get a hold of.
that may be. It may be one of those things.
Just take them out of mothballs,
but they
guys.
They don't look that good either. Like, they don't have that production value.
No, but you know what they do? Like, they may not look great, but what's interesting about them is that they go to extents with the design of the motorcycles and the costumes that are unnecessary, but kind of you kind of can't stop looking at. Like, the fact that all the motorcycles have metal horse heads on them. It was like, suddenly it's a George Romero movie. Like, suddenly it's what was that movie? Where you have all of the, like, medieval guys on motorcycles. I think Ed Harris is in it. The internet is currently aflame with people just screaming at me right now.
Knight Riders!
Fuck! Ah, damn it! Stargrove! And we're back. Yes, Knight Riders is the name of that movie. And not to be confused with Knight Rider, which is far superior.
Well, that's, you know, and that's another weird thing about this movie. Like, watching
it's
this
not Knight Rider.
Well, no, but it feels like a high budget trauma movie at times.
Ooh,
like there's Ooh. Moments where it's like,
God, Cargo, I like this movie so much. Why are you trying to ruin this for me?
Am I wrong?
No, and that's what I'm asking. Why are you trying to ruin this for me?
Because that's like at moments, it's because certain trauma movies, you know, have walk this line between we're taking the concept seriously, but we're not taking this seriously at all. And that's very much what this feels like. And then there's almost every scene without John Stamos and Vanity feel like it's a trauma movie. And then we get Stamos and Vanity again, and it's like, oh, wait, no, this wants to be a real movie, and they think they're actors. And
they think they're actors. Isn't that cute? They think they're actors.
Well, have you seen this movie?
Yeah, no, I'm very familiar with this movie.
When the best actor in your movie is Vanity.
Yeah.
A woman who spent the 80s taking her clothes off in movies.
A woman so nice, they named her once.
Once.
Just Vanity.
And fucking awesome. I mean, fucking Action Jackson.
No, I mean, she's great. Dragon. She's great. I do want to say that according to an interview in Variety with John Stamos about this movie, he said that Vanity at this time was all, you know, highway to the cuckoo zone. And one thing she loved to do is she would blast the prop machine guns randomly between takes, like fucking Scarface, just grab them and fire them off. And that he had to end up telling her, "Lighten up, Denise," which is her real name. And she fucking hated that. Incidentally,
I just can you think about that for a moment? Think about John Stamos say you could hear him saying that in your head.
Lighten up, Denise. And incidentally, that is now my go-to phrase to get people to tone it the hell down. Like, for example, Cargill, I know you hate the Bratz movie, but this is my niece's confirmation, and everyone in the church is staring at us. Lighten up, Denise. So that is going to be my new go-to tone it down phrase.
Why did you have to remind me that the Bratz movie exists?
Lighten up, Denise.
Look, you know what? I saw it. I actually watched it from beginning to end in a theater. I wrote the review. Let me leave it at that. Stop reminding me.
Stargrove. Yeah, but here's where I will take umbrage with the comparison of this to a trauma film, because I'm with you that maybe the director knew that this movie was going to be shit. Maybe he knew what kind of film he was making. John Stamos definitely thought this was not only going to be his big break, but he took this so fucking seriously that he actually trained in gymnastics and broke his ankle in the process to prepare to play Stargrove, of all things.
Stargrove!
So
one of the Stargroves.
One of the two Stargroves, because the other one, and the reason, here's one of the big reasons that I love this movie unabashedly, is that I am a huge James Bond nerd.
Oh, yeah.
I've been a huge James Bond nerd my whole life. You know, forgive the braggadocio, but my knowledge is formidable. Like, this is one of those things I know a lot about, is the Bond franchise. But in recent years, the other thing I've become a big fan of is movies and subgenres that should not be. And one of those subgenres that should not be that I absolutely love, and this harkens back to, you know, junk food cinema past, are knockoff movies. And James Bond is so much a part of the collective film-going experience of the last, I don't know, two generations. There's an entire filmic culture devoted solely to ripping off James Bond.
Yeah, and oddly enough, all of the early James Bonds play a role in a movie that is essentially playing upon them having been James Bond.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Sean Connery in an actual Bond knockoff.
Never Say Never Again.
And then you have Roger Moore in...
Spice World?
No.
What?
No, Cannonball Run.
Oh, yes, of course. Of course.
Where he was supposed to be playing James Bond and they couldn't get the rights, so they just had him playing Roger Moore, but then they decided it would be funnier if you were playing a guy who believed he was Roger Moore, played by Roger Moore. But it's all Bond jokes.
Yeah.
And then you have this, George Lazenby.
Yes, the Bond franchise equivalent of a disposable wet wipe and is in this movie.
You know who he is? He's Val Kilmer or
George Clooney as Batman. Oh, like, he's the Batman.
Or no. You know who? You know where? I'll go. I'll take you one step further. He's the Brandon Routh of Bonds.
Ooh, I don't know who that's insulting more. That's my favorite part of that comment. I can't find the serpent's tail.
George Lazenby is the Brandon Routh of Bond of James Bond.
So take that, everyone who saw both of those movies. Good job. But yeah, so because James Bond is so massively popular at the time and to this day, there were 30 James Bond ripoff parody satires released between 1964 and 1969 alone.
And one of them was a Woody Allen movie.
Yes. And a couple of my favorites, I'm just going to list them off here. 008 Operation Exterminate, which is directed by Umberto Lenzi. You have Agent 077, Mission Bloody Mary, another Italian Bond ripoff because...
Wait. Why are we mentioning Italian Bond ripoffs and not mentioning the Italian Bond ripoff?
Well, I'm getting there.
Okay.
Because giant fling, flang, and surprise, the Italians know how to rip off other people's movies. If you would like a back catalog education opportunity, see our 1990 Bronx Warriors episode on this. And of course, Operation Kid Brother, a.k.a. O.K. Connery. Is that the one? Is that the one you were?
No,
really.
Danger Diabolic.
Oh, of course. Yeah, but this one.
Oh, of course.
No, but no. There's a lot of things Danger Diabolic is stealing from. Operation Kid Brother goes so far as to cast Sean Connery's brother to play the brother of some unnamed super spy that gets killed. It also stars Lois Maxwell, who was the once and then current Moneypenny, and Bond franchise Prime's M, Bernard Lee, to play basically M and Moneypenny, and then also stars Adolfo Celli, who played Largo in Thunderball. So it's like populating its entire movie with either people from the Bond franchise or people who look suspiciously like people from the Bond franchise. It's prime time plagiarism. And it's again, the Italians, they know how to rip people off.
What's the other, is it Agent Double D 73 or 73 Double D? What is?
Oh, is that the porno one?
Yeah, the one with the woman.
With the enormous fucking breasts.
That the title is the size of her breasts.
Yeah.
With Agent attached.
I hate that I know exactly what you're talking about, but I can't pretend I don't know it. I think it's a Doris Wishman film. I
know
the name of the fucking director of that movie.
Stop it.
Why?
Stop it.
Stargrove! Never Too Young to Die is, by this whole rationale, a razzlin' dazzlin' 80s-tacular James Bond knockoff, which is why it goes so far as to cast George Lazenby, who again is the disposable wet wipe of the Bond franchise, as Stargrove's father.
By the way, you were right on Doris Wishman, and it's Double Agent 73. That's why.
The saddest part of that is I never doubted that I was wrong about Doris. I wish that I could have been like, maybe I'm incorrect, but no, got to be 100%
sure. You
know
your shitty nudie movies.
Thanks, HBO Real Sex. Anyway, so they do... What this is they do a couple of things kind of trying to pass off the torch to a new younger James Bond, they're able to do a couple things with the villain that no Bond film prior to this had ever done.
And shouldn't have done.
Well, I don't know about that. Because one of the things that's really impressive to me is, as we're going through the plot of this movie, at the beginning, there is a sequence where as...
Yeah, because we've gotten this far in the episode.
And we really haven't started on the plot, which is, again, we have the senior Stargrove, Drew Stargrove, which I thought was a little underwhelming, but whatever. Drew Stargrove, played by George Lazenby, the one-hitter James Bond, who gets murdered by terrorist Ragnar while trying to infiltrate and protect the water supply because they get a tip that that's what he's trying to do. That, A, number one, the biggest thing this movie does that no Bond film, the villain kills James Bond just outright. Like, there's a couple minutes of monologuing, but it's like as soon as Ragnar has the drop on Stargrove, boom, done, dead. And that, to me, is impressive in and of itself because no other Bond villain has been able to do that. And then the other thing...
To be
thing,
fair, he was also a very terrible Bond.
This is true.
Like not as James Bond. I mean, like, in this movie, like, yeah. He's a terrible secret agent.
What is his number one gadget in this that he uses in this movie? It's a fucking bulletproof umbrella. Like, he's the goddamn Burgess Meredith Penguin.
Hey, let's sneak into this place by blowing up the wall.
Yeah.
Like they're trying to sneak in with explosives.
They're also trying to sneak into what is the Hoover Dam. So I'm not really sure like where they're trying to get to. But too bad Ragnar and his army of punk goblins are there to intercept him. By the way, that's another thing I love about this movie is it's another in the long lineage of 80s movies that is terrified of punk culture.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Zach Carlson wrote an entire book on this, Destroy All Movies, which I highly recommend, which is just about the 1980s into the 90s featuring the weirdest examples of quote-unquote punks and new wave weirdos and like all this stuff where clearly whoever was making the movie had no idea what punk culture really was but was terrified of it. It's kind of the way I see a lot of British genre movies now misrepresenting hoodie culture and youth culture and like being terrified of it. There's
hoodie?
Just the youth culture. Like movies like Citadel would be a good example of that. Or even Attack the Block kind of like shows you like how England views a lot of its own like underprivileged youth culture. But anyway, so the army of complete just maniacs, and there is an honest to crom barbarian working for Ragnar as well. Why? Who fucking knows?
But yeah, who thinks he's in a post-apocalyptic movie.
He definitely does, because that guy's first response to any situation is rape. So he definitely
tearing
thinks,
off his clothes, grunting.
Yes.
And occasionally trying to rape.
And it's funny that Vanity's in this movie, because clearly the barbarian and Prince at this time were going to the same hairstylist, because he has Prince's haircut and Arnold Schwarzenegger's wardrobe, and you have yourself a barbarian in this movie. So the elder Stargrove ends up getting murdered. Now, his son, also named Stargrove, has no idea that his dad's a spy. He thinks his dad works for an oil company. He's told he was killed in a car accident and slowly starts to realize, no, my dad was some kind of super spy.
Slowly, as in he inherits a farm, realizes he's a farmer, goes out to visit the farm, and there's people on his farm having a fight, and... So he gets into a series of fights and then kind of forgets that he was in a fight. Like, just like, oh, well, that's okay. It's not like, dude, we need to call the cops. There were some crazy fucking people on our property. It's like, oh, glad that's done.
That is the John Stamos of this era. The John Stamos of this era is just so unflappable. Like, he's just so brazenly confident on screen that he can't bring himself as a performer to be flustered by anything. It's just like... Whatever, I'm John Stamos, and I'm in the room, so clearly everything's great.
I have a beautiful floral shirt, and I'm good.
I have a muskrat pompadour that cannot be defeated.
The pompadour and the floral shirts, they go all the way through this movie.
Oh, boy, the wardrobe for John Stamos in this movie. Like, yeah, I don't need you, General Hospital. Fuck off, regular gig on television. I'm going to be a movie star. That kind of bravado is what is seething underneath John Stamos throughout this whole movie, and why the most flustering thing to him in this movie is Vanity taking off her clothes.
Wait, was John Stamos I didn't know he was on General Hospital.
He was on General Hospital. He was offered a longtime gig and turned it down because he was convinced he was going to be a movie star. This movie...
Is he who Joey Tribbiani was based on?
No. No, because John Stamos was ultimately successful.
Ah.
So I think that was the
Are
difference.
You saying that Dr. Drake Ramore was not...
Hey, I'm not here to cast aspersions on Dr. Drake Ramore. I've said that from the beginning of this podcast. But
I don't think we said that at the beginning.
No, the beginning of the run of this show 2 years ago, I believe I said, before we get started on our very first episode, oddly want to proclaim that I'm not here to cast aspersions on Dr. Drake Ramore. And everyone went, what? Stargrove. So, yeah, so that's... I have no idea where I was going with this, and then I just
and
got...
I'm glad, because that's how this movie works.
That's how this movie works. It will get into your brain and remove pieces of information from it.
How is the computer doing? Does it have enough RAM K?
I am checking the RAM K. I think we're going on RAM K.
Program this computer.
I may need to consult with computer specialist Robert England.
Yeah, who's just... It's one of those times where it says special appearance by, and you're like, that's exactly what this was. He's there... There's no particular reason why they have Robert Englund.
No, there's a very good reason. It's because there's so many things in this movie that will haunt your nightmares. So why not put Robert Englund in a varsity sweater high atop that list? Because that's what he's wearing in this movie.
He's just playing the computer expert who occasionally just says, yes, it's working, boss. Like, and then at the end, when they're in their like Thunderdome-esque type compound...
Mm-hmm.
He's just sitting there by Ragnar, Ragnar's on his throne. And he's just kind of sitting there. Like, he's literally just, it's like they called him up and said, can you come down for a few days and just hang out and be mellow?
Yeah.
And so he's just like, yeah, I'll be on film and be really mellow.
I'll take a break from filming the sixth fucking Nightmare on Elm Street movie to come be in your little spy film. I do want to say this, though. In the early 90s, This movie, Never Too Young to Die, it's a better James Bond Jr. type of concept than James Bond Jr., that awful 90s cartoon that even pint-sized Bry Guy could not sit through. Do you remember this cartoon, James Bond Jr.?
He learned the game from his Uncle James. Now he's heir to the name. James Bond. James Bond Jr.
is fucking awful. It was basically, the idea was do like James Bond babies, right? So if he's called James Bond Jr., it has to be James Bond's son, which makes sense considering James Bond beds every woman he's ever met with nary a condom to be found. He could have 50, a legion of James Bond Juniors, but instead they're like, it's his nephew, which is weird because it was never established that Bond had siblings. Nor would a nephew named after an uncle be a junior.
And but then it would be Bond. It would be Bastard Bond.
Ooh, Bond Bastard would be a great fucking cartoon. I would watch that every damn day. No, but it was awful. So this movie actually serves a better function as the James Bond Jr. we never got in the 90s, even though we got a cartoon called fucking James Bond Jr. So that definitely appealed to me.
It's no If Looks Could Kill.
It's not If Looks Could Kill. I think. I haven't seen that movie.
Have you never seen Richard Grieco in If Looks Could Kill?
Should we double feature that with this movie? Is that the way to go?
I feel like we should. Like, it's exactly that kind of movie where a teenage boy played by someone in his 20s becomes a super spy.
Sure.
Accidentally.
Like you do. You just luck into it. That's one of the weirder scenes in this movie. Is at one point John Stamos is getting beaten up by two of the more leather daddy-y punk army maniacs in this movie?
That are acting in this particular scene. This is the most trauma of the scenes. It reminds me very much of Surf Nazis Must Die.
What doesn't remind you of Surf Nazis Must Die, though? I mean, honestly, if we're really getting at the heart of it, you've mentioned that movie at least once just now. So
yeah, no, I really did. I really do mention that movie once.
All of the one time you've ever mentioned that movie.
No, but this is what you were talking about with the punks. This movie has a very trauma view of punks. Like it is exactly like Surf Nazis Must Die or Class of 1984 in terms of punk bullying.
Yes.
And we've got these punks who are having way too much fun. like beating somebody up, not like I'm not in a way that is realistic. Like I'm enjoying beating the crap out of somebody. Like they're literally cackling.
They're like getting they're on off
Joker
on
gas.
They are straight up getting off on just whipping the shit out of John Stamos,
as you would, but, well, yeah. but in a way that's a little too over the top.
So John Stamos looks at a picture of his dad and finds the inner strength to be a secret agent, I guess, maybe, question mark? I'm not sure, but he just gets up and starts to beat the ever-living shit out of them, which ends with him grabbing a shotgun and saying his Bond, James Bond line. He's like, the name is Stargrove, Lance Stargrove, Stargrove! So, and then the punks run away. Now we have a fight on our hands, I guess, because I feel like Vanity probably could have taken down the entire lot of these.
This. Yeah, because that's the weird thing about this movie, and the oddly misogynistic thing about this movie is Vanity's character is quite an accomplished secret agent and is a fucking badass, but stupidly gets herself into situations that she needs a teenager gymnast to come in and save her.
Here's the balance, though. Here's the weight on the other side of the scale, in that, yes, totally misogynistic, John Stamos is 100% not needed. However, at the beginning of this movie, they also establish that Drew Stargrove is kind of a fucking moron. And by that, I mean the way Ragnar figures out that he's the one that stole his disc is that he captures his Drew Stargrove's female accomplice and is like, who did you give the disc to? And she won't say, but she's wearing earrings that apparently...
A necklace.
No. It's definitely earrings because he rips it out of her ear. He rips it out of her ear and she like reacts to it. And it's apparently either the family crest or some symbol that he immediately recognizes as Drew Stargrove. And it's like, motherfucker, you are a secret agent. Do not give women your family crest to wear on their person while they're on a mission. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Well, I feel like that's like one of the big nods to James Bond, if anything, because James Bond is one of the worst secret agents of all time.
Yeah, but that's...
Everybody knows who James Bond is. The minute they see him, they're like, oh shit, it's James Bond.
But that's never explained. It's just a thing. And it's only like half the time. If you watch the entirety of the James Bond franchise, which I recommend you do if you have yourself a lazy week to yourself, half the time, the villains immediately know that's James Bond. The other half the time, they have to be told or they punch it into their computer that apparently taps into the secret database at MI6 of every 00 agent and can immediately pull it up like they're Googling that shit.
Well, because he's on Google. It's like,
Google.
Secret agent. Oh, it's James Bond. Fuck.
James Bond would like to G-chat with
this
you.
Do you accept? This is the guy who's here. This is clearly James Bond, like every movie. And so that's exactly what happens with Stargrove.
Oh, who didn't password protect the MI6 Google Hangout? God damn it, James!
And of course...
Fuck!
And then, of course, he recognizes James Bond's son, you know, Lazenby's son, instantly as well, because, well, yeah, you would know who his son is.
Oh, but don't forget the brilliant way he tries to flesh out that information, which is, Stargrove! And then John Stamos, the worst performance of the whole movie... Oh, I'm sorry. Should that name mean something to me? My name is Billy. It's like, you're both terrible. Now, both of you are terrible at this game.
This is one of those... It's some of these details that make me think that the director really is kind of in on the joke. You know, you mentioned it earlier. Like, he's getting the shit kicked out of him, and he sees this picture. Well, there are two scenes in the movie where we see the picture on the shelf, and then he picks the picture up and looks at it. And it's a different picture that he picked up off the shelf. Like, you can clearly see, like, there is one picture, and then we cut to the insert shot of the picture, and it's a completely different picture of them, and then he puts it back on the shelf, and it's the original picture again. It's like, you're fucking with us, right? Like, this is you fucking with us.
These are the pictures I put on Facebook. I tag them 007. It's like, that's why you're getting caught! That's why... God damn it, James!
Yeah, I feel like there's many moments in this movie that is really like, yeah, no, this is supposed to be funny. You're supposed to be in on the joke of this.
But they want, like, the people in the movie
don't
like,
know it.
They don't know it. Not only do they not know it, but like One of the things I found really interesting when I was doing my research was that Gene Simmons, in prepping for this character, apparently based his portrayal and his especially that song that he sings, which is "It Takes a Man Like Me to Be a Woman Like Me." He's basing that on Jane Country, who's the punk singer that Hedwig and the Angry Inch is based on.
Yeah.
And then you have John Stamos, who's literally turning down regular TV work, training for the movie, breaking his... Like, they recognize now that it's bad. I don't believe either one of them at the time thought that, and I think that's what saves this movie. I think the earnestness, the maybe you could call it the Velvet Von obliviousness of these two actors, like, they are going for it so hard. It's like John Stamos is putting all of his rotten eggs in this one leaky basket. And it's just like he really wants this to work. And it's endearing. You can't hate John Stamos in this movie. It is physically, scientifically impossible. And you're just kind of like, Stargrove. And you want to ruffle his hair, but you're worried you wouldn't get that hand back. Because seriously, the depth and thickness of that pompadour is kind of ridiculous. Yeah.
And the when the movie is taking itself seriously, it is taking itself really seriously. Like, some of the stunts in this movie are dangerous fucking stunts.
Yes, yes.
Like, the scene with that they have a fight scene with motorcycles against a car, which you would later see done 25 years later in, probably 15 years later in the Fast and Furious movies. And it's done as well as it's done in Fast and Furious movies.
I live my life one Stargrove at a time.
Yeah, you know, you're driving under a tractor trailer, which is not a easy stunt.
No.
And you're fighting guys on motorcycles while traveling at 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it's like, shit, this is a lot like the stunt work in the Maniac Cop movies.
Yes,
where it's like,
yes,
holy shit, like they're... they're like going for it, but the Maniac Cop movies were trying to be good and actually being entertaining, solid, well-crafted movies. And here's well-crafted stunts put together with over-the-top performances and then moments of just high comedy, but like intentional, accidental high comedy.
Yeah.
Like, we haven't talked about one of what I believe is probably the second most ridiculous love scene of all time.
It is. It is. And before we dive into that, like John Stamos did, heyo, I want to go back to that point. Lighten up, Denise. Lighten up.
Lighten up, Denise.
God damn it, Denise. You lighten up. The whole thing about the stunts, there are two shots in that sequence you mentioned that are wholesale, shot for shot, taken from Road Warrior. And I mean that as a compliment because they frame it and execute it almost as well as George Miller does. And that stunt work is incredible to watch. And at the beginning of the movie, they're trying to establish, I won't go so far as to say Artie, but they try to establish...
Yeah, Artie's a stretch.
No, Artie's a stretch. Artie is a Velvet Von stretch.
Like, watch the scenes juxtapose the scenes here of Ragnar and his cult versus Cobra. And these are movies that came out weeks apart from one another.
If nothing else, this is the movie that will make you respect Cobra more, and they should have put that on the fucking poster. But no, there's moments like the beginning where his father's falling after being shot. He falls off the rings during they're trying to juxtapose those shots. They're trying to create parallels. They're going for some more artistic angles. Like, they are really fucking trying at moments in this movie, to the point where I don't feel like it's a situation where there were too many cooks in the kitchen. I feel like all of the cooks were doing their jobs, and the head chef is a Velvet Von asshat. I really think whoever made the final call, whether it was the studio, the editor, the director, whoever was where the buck stopped, was an asshat. Because seriously, there are so many moments where you can tell people are trying in this movie, and that's what makes it so watchable. And that's what I love so much about it, is all of these people, and that's why I can't totally disagree with it, but that's why I really hate comparing it to Troma, because my big problem with Troma, nobody's fucking trying in a Troma movie.
I disagree with that.
Nobody's putting forth an ounce of effort in a fucking Troma film.
I disagree with.
I will spit on the ground.
There were a lot of young guys who were really cutting their teeth in trauma. But the thing is the trauma movies never take themselves seriously enough. They're always kind of tongue-in-cheek.
I'm okay with tongue-in-cheek. I'm not okay with garbage. And I feel like...
So you and I have very different feelings on trauma films. And now I've been traumatized. Folks out there are finding out why we never talk about trauma movies.
No. Maybe we will sometime, and you can all just crawl out of your basements, and I can't do it.
Give yourself over to the love.
No.
Man. Love movies. No. Love.
I am the toxic avoider. I will not fucking watch any trauma movies from my cold dead podcast. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah,
this is a really oddly structured episode of the show. Like,
does this episode have structure?
Yeah.
Stuck Groove. Stuck Groove. But this love scene that you were mentioning.
Oh, yeah. Now,
back to the banging.
If there's ever any reason to watch this movie that isn't John Stamos, that isn't over-the-top fucking Gene Simmons, that isn't George Lazenby playing George Lazenby as weird Bond, it's this fucking love scene.
Yes, this love scene.
Calling it a love scene, it is...
It pushes the boundaries of the definitions of both of those words.
It is a seduction...
Oh,
that,
boy.
That really, really...
You know what I know what it is. I know it is fucking... If a love scene were directed by Lenny and Squiggy from Laverne and Shirley, it would be this fuck... Because the whole opening is her just taking off her clothes to seduce him and him eating an apple like...
He's losing his mind, and she knows he's losing his mind.
Dude, just fuck her. She's wanted to fuck you since square one. She's got a Stargrove fetish. She banged your dad. She's here immediately. She's already said, I never thanked you for saving my life. Like, she is all up on your little Stamos. She wants you to fill her house, but instead you're just like, no, we can't. And then she tries to seduce you.
Okay, imagine what a seduction scene looked like in the late 80s, early 90s in a commercial.
A commercial for
like
apples.
We're trying to sell you a wine cooler, so we're going to try to seduce you. Like that kind of commercial that...
Thank you for your bra support.
That is very over the top and obvious because we're selling sex in 30 seconds. Now stretch that out to 5 minutes.
Remember when BJ meant Bartles and James? That's kind of the sexual wine cooler combination we're talking about.
5 minutes.
It goes on. Wait. And then the actual, once they give into it, it's just her topless being thrown hither and thither by him while they're making out hard. And then eventually... Almost mercifully, we get the pan to the curtains because I'm like, if you guys aren't actually going to fuck, stop like power bombing her into the bed over and over again while you make out. Like, both of you just discovered what kissing is.
5 minutes.
Jesus.
It's the most ridiculous. Like, it's not the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen because I fucking love Megaforce and the skydiving seduction, love scene is far. A far greater, more over-the-top thing.
The love scenes always end, even in the 80s.
In the 80s. This one, however, I can't believe it exists. Like, it's like...
That's what I love about this whole movie. Yeah. There's so many things about it that should not be.
They should not be.
Like, none of this movie should be.
This movie, it's... God damn it. Mm. But yeah, this love scene was the thing that... Like, I was prepared... For hermaphroditic Gene Simmons.
Were you?
Yeah.
Is anyone?
Yeah, because once you're told hermaphroditic Gene Simmons, that's exactly what you get. And you're like, oh, yeah, no, this is definitely hermaphroditic Gene Simmons. What you're not prepared for is how, especially in this day and age, how inappropriate it is. Like, even Gene Simmons, like, seems to go over the top with being a hermaphrodite and seems to be making fun of it.
But I would prefer that to him playing it safe with it and making it seem like that character's not comfortable being, I don't know if you'd say trans or gender confused.
Hermaphroditic.
Like, I would be more offended if he didn't go, if he didn't play it to the level where you can tell that character loved being who they are.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is that he's playing... hermaphrodite as if he's a transgender, and that's what gets kind of offensive. It's because he really does, like you said, it was based on this singer.
Yeah.
You know, this is definitely not Hedwig, but it's kind of playing it like Hedwig. Like it's,
but there's no, but I feel like there's no malice in that ignorance. Like they're not playing it that way because they're stereotyping. That is literally Jean Simmons' understanding of hermaphrodites.
Yeah, and it's so over the top that it's wrong. But
I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that
I buy into it because of how happy
he seems to be being that character.
They go full on to the point that in one of the fight scenes, John Stamos pulls down his top and bites his breast.
Oh, the way he beats the villain at the end of the movie is so fucking appropriate for Bond fans.
Yeah.
Because if you watch any Bond movie, you know that D game, that 007, or maybe it's 008 and a half, I don't know. But his D game is such that if he beds a femme fatale, she switches allegiances immediately. So the fact that you have a James Bond basically going up against, for all intents and purposes, a female villain, the way he finally beats Ragnar is he convinces him that before Ragnar kills him, Stargrove just wants one last kiss, and fucking Ragnar cannot resist going in for that kiss, and that's when he throws up his own Xenia on a top and flips Ragnar off the top of the dam. And, by the way, the second of two epic dummy kills in this movie, probably the most epic dummy kill in the movie, is we watch this mannequin, who might as well be Kim Cattrall, falling from the top of the dam all the way down, splatting on the side of a wall. And like they were just like, nope, shoot the whole thing. I don't care if it looks fake. You shoot the whole fucking thing.
And we're showing it.
It is.
We paid for this dummy.
It is Velvet Vaughn. Amazing. Like to watch it slam into the side and keep falling. You know what it reminds me of is in The Shadow when Siwon Khan makes the sailor, the guy who is actually in like Mad Men and Boardwalk Empire, kill himself off the top of the Empire State Building, and when they cut to the wide shot, he doesn't fall all the way to the ground. He falls, hits like one of the sides of the Empire State Building, and then keeps falling. Like it's so brutal. It's more brutal because there's like a stop midway down.
Yeah. And dummy kills. Yeah, dummy kills. It's
Stargrove.
Like this is where how can you take this movie seriously when you've got a sustained dummy kill shot like that? That's clearly a fucking dummy.
By the way, Sustained Dummy Kill is the name of my new band.
Your new cover band?
My new cover band, Sustained Dummy Kill.
Your Crash Test Dummies cover band?
Yes. We do that, and then we do all the songs from the soundtracks of Mannequin and Mannequin 2 on the Move. So I mean, we're limited.
So essentially, your Starship.
Yeah.
Your Starship cover.
Well, I think we're a little bit better than Starship. I'm just saying. I mean, if we really want to get down to brass tacks, we're slightly better.
Sustained Dummy Kill's the name of my sex tape.
There you go. That real doll will never be the same. You know what I find more offensive? Stargrove. What I find more offensive.
Stargrove. See, the best part about the Stargrove song is that it's Stargrove, and then we go down an octave. Stargrove. And that's the song.
No, what the best part is that if you think about it, if you remember this, the fake documentary Waiting for Guffman, there's a song in that play they're putting on.
It's one of the Christopher Guest series.
There's a song in that play that they're putting on called Stool Boom. That's essentially the exact same song. If you like, every time you say Stargrove, just say Stool Boom. And it's the same fucking song.
Right.
Oh, so every time I watch this movie now and they go Stargrove, I'm like, Stool Boom. In the parlor or the pool room. Yeah, it's basically the same song. That's the best part. But I find less offensive Gene Simmons' portrayal of a hermaphrodite than his what in the ginger goddamn hellfire is going on with his alter ego Carruthers? Okay, sorry.
That's actually the bit that I love the best about this movie.
But it's
like the one thing that I was like,
fuck?
Like the first time you see him, I'm like, that's Gene Simmons in a beard. And then it's like they're talking to him and he's like, you think there's a mole inside? And it's like, it's fucking Gene Simmons.
Okay.
Like it's him. It's clearly him.
Here's my biggest problem with that. First of all, you don't hire Gene Simmons to be the villain in your teen spy movie because kids don't know who the fuck Gene Simmons is. You hire him because teens do know who the fuck Gene Simmons is. So trying to put a fake beard and a fake orange mop on him like he's some kind of goddamn Opie Santa Claus, what is the point? Not only that, but you have literally in the first scene of the movie shown him as Carruthers betraying the elder Stargrove. So we know he's a bad guy regardless of whether or not he's Ragnar. So why continue on this delusion that there's extra tension to be mined out of? Oh, but it's really... Who gives a shit? Even if it was the perfect disguise and you didn't recognize at all that it was Gene Simmons, we already know he's a bad guy. So the big, like, unmasking like a fucking Scooby-Doo episode at the end of this movie is completely neutered by the fact that you've already shown him to be a traitor.
Again, that scene, so trauma... Like when he's
with his eyes rolled back in his head, like he's having an orgasm for 10 minutes.
Hair going,
Oh, his laugh in this movie is epic. He's got some Mark Hamill shit going on in this movie.
He really does. Like that's the best way to put it. Like, yeah, it's Mark Hamill Joker. Like it's Joker gas stuff. It's this is why I had a very hard time believing that Gene Simmons wasn't in on the joke. And you know the director's got to be in on the joke. Like if the director thought,
I think he's the. I really think the director's the only one in on the joke. I really do. I think everybody else thinks that they're doing a really fucking good job, which is always my mark of an enjoyable bad movie versus a completely unwatchable bad movie. Is I feel like 90% of the people involved in this movie really are going for it and really think they're doing a good job, and that's what makes the movie entertaining as opposed to fucking.
But that's movies like Torque, and that's movies like I Know Who Killed Me. And that's why I love I Know Who Killed Me was because, you know, I've met Chris Sievertson several times. We have some good friends in common and I know his sense of humor. And the minute I watch this movie, I'm like, Chris Sievertson is laughing his ass off behind the camera. He thinks this is hilarious. And everyone else in the theater is like, what the fuck are we watching? And I'm howling. And I'm like, this is funny.
You know what movie
and
made me?
And that's what works here is I feel like the director... Like, this is not it's not one of those accidental bad movies. It's not a movie where people were trying and you're laughing at how much they fail. This is a movie where the director's like, they want me to make a movie about a hermaphroditic villain with John Stamos as the hero and Vanity as the lead, the femme fatale.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's fucking do this.
Yeah.
Like, it is a movie. Like her next movie, the movie that follows this, that I happen to like love, Action Jackson, is a movie that takes itself seriously and is funny and is an entertaining film. This is a movie. It's like this is just a mess, but I get it. Like it's fun and it's definitely something that you need to see at least once. And it made me upset that it's not available readily. Like
on YouTube now.
You can only watch it on YouTube,
but it's only available for purchase on VHS. It does not exist on DVD at all.
Yeah.
It was one of those situations where they got a distributor after the film was made at a market.
Yeah.
It got picked up, but then was mostly released in drive-ins, which could not make more sense.
Right.
Why
was this not a canon movie?
You know, that's a great question. This is a Golan and Globus movie.
It should be a canon.
You know why? Because they weren't there from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Golan and Globus are the guys who are there from the ground floor. They make the poster before the movie's made and they sell it.
But this feels like it's a fucking canon.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
And the poster for this is fucking fantastic.
Oh my God. Here's a fun fact that in my research I found out. John Stamos is apparently thinking of buying the rights to this movie because he believes there might be a cult audience to it. And you can consider this episode our ring, ding, dang, an endorsement of that plan.
Oh.
Do it, Stamos.
I hope to God he does it. Like, dear God, this movie, like, yeah, this is a movie that needs to be on streaming. There are people who will buy the Blu-ray of this.
Hashtag Stargrove. Let's start a fucking movement.
Stargrove!
Let's put it on Twitter. Stamos, you need to fucking buy the rights back. Get with Shout Factory. Release a fucking Blu-ray. That's right.
And you know what he needs to follow up with? He needs to get with Mondo and have them put out a vinyl of this soundtrack.
I just got so hard.
You did.
Oh,
you really did.
Both my man bits and my Ragnar lady
Mondo
bits.
Mondo would vinyl the fuck out of this soundtrack.
Bloosh. Like, I would love like a Kevin Tong or a Tyler Stout fucking Mondo poster.
It's got a Gene Simmons fucking song on it, for fuck's sake.
That's true.
And it not a Kiss does. Gene Simmons song.
No.
Gene Simmons doing his version of Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Like, it is...
Hedwig and the Angry Kiss.
That's the thing, is the one thing that can be said about this movie.
I feel like we've said way more than one thing about it, but yeah.
But the one thing that can truly be said about this movie is that every scene is entertaining.
Yeah.
And when it's not being over the top and being something that you haven't, like a new version of something that you've seen before, but you've never seen it this way, it then becomes Hard Ticket to Hawaii or one of these really craptastic 80s, early 90s movies that is delightful to watch. Like,
totally.
It's where the familiarity of those scenes is entertaining in and of itself. And then it does something else.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, the ending becomes, there's a whole series of movies. And God, we've seen these movies together. And I'm trying to think of what they're called, but like there was a bunch of karate movies in the late 70s, early 80s, that this emulates without sure. the karate.
Sure. Like, because that requires training.
Yeah. And yeah, so
that requires more than just learning how to jump on a trampoline.
So they just put punks in the place of martial artists instead. And it's just you keep grabbing your head going, what is going on? And you kind of know what's going on, and yet you never know why it's going on.
Yeah.
Like, and what is, let's end this episode asking this very important question. The fuck is Gene Simmons' plan? Like, he lays out his plan in the beginning and you think it makes sense. It's
it doesn't even make sense to his own people.
He wants to blackmail the city, but he never attempts to blackmail the city. Like, he just gets the stuff.
He doesn't get that far. He just doesn't get that far.
Like, so fuck it. Let's just poison the water source. Okay.
All right. He says it, he says it initially at the beginning, and this whole crew starts looking at each other like, what? I'm going to poison the... They literally look at each other like, why would we... We don't... They shot a scene where his own cronies are like, I don't understand that. And then he literally goes, I'm going to poison the water supply for gold, for ransom, for jewels, for money. I'm like, okay, you don't know how economies work, because you basically want to give them... You want them to give you every type of currency there is at once. So if you have to sell your own henchmen on it, it's probably not a very well laid out plan. But my question is this. Have we established a rapport enough with the audience that we can get personal for a second?
Can we get personal?
I think we can get personal for a second. Stargrove. Because... The thing that struck me, Cargill, on this viewing of the movie, which opened up so many doors I'm maybe not comfortable with in my brain as to why I love it so much, is that I realized that Never Too Young to Die is the plot of Never Too Young to Die shockingly, eerily mirrors the plot of a screenplay I wrote in a film I began to shoot while I was in college. And I didn't see this movie until I moved to Austin. But there are so many parallels between this and a Brian Salisbury original production called The Campus Job that it was unnerving to me in a very...
Is it a hermaphroditic villain?
No. It was about... I'm just going to lay out the plot of my movie and you can kind of tell me where the similarities lie. It was about a kid who's in college. He's flat broke. His roommate is an engineering major who makes a lot of gadgets. Like, he's very good at making gadgets, especially audio gadgets for bugging things. And it turns out this kid finds out that his dad was not a salesman, but in fact was a hitman for the mafia. And so he ends up crossing paths with the mob guys who let him take jobs as well. And he starts taking on jobs so that he can. So it's like, basically, if you replace the whole spy element with the mafia, you have The Campus Job. And it was so crazy to me the way these two movies started lining up, especially since I'd never seen or heard of Never Too Young to Die when I was in college. And I mean, don't get me wrong, like it's I thought at the time that I was Guy Ritchie, but I was more like Guy Ritchie's
Guy Fieri.
No, yeah, I was more like Guy Fieri. I was just like, pound it, bro! We're making a movie! Horseradish, boom! Like, it was...
Donkey sauce!
Yeah, this movie was donkey sauce. Campus job. That is exactly how I would describe the campus job.
I think we found our unless you've got something better, donkey sauce kind of needs to be the junk food pairing.
I have a junk food pairing, but I do like donkey sauce. I will say this. If we get back to that $200 level, I may release the footage that I shot for the campus job. So keep that in mind, prospective patrons. I wasn't Guy Ritchie. I was Guy Ritchie's simple but earnestly trying brother, Reggie Blimey Cakes Ritchie. That was me. And it's
Reggie
just,
Ritchie.
Reggie Ritchie. And it was terrible. Everything about it was Velvet Von terrible.
You weren't Rick.
No, I was more of a Reggie, I feel like the amount of things I didn't know about movies and trying to make one of my own. But this is the movie, just to end this, to wrap this all up nicely. Never Too Young to Die is a lot of fun. It makes a lot of mistakes. There are a lot of people trying, but it is ultimately the movie that couldn't even get John Stamos laid, because in that same Variety interview, he said he took a girl to see it at the drive-in, and it, quote, didn't help him at all. Stargrove cock block.
How bad does a movie have to be that John Stamos can't get laid in the 80s?
How bad does a movie have to be? That's some weird, wild stuff. It does nothing for you at all. And I'm just going to check in with Bond again. Bond, are you doing better about keeping your personal info offline?
I don't know. I just joined Tinder. It's like, God damn it, Bond! I'm swiping left. Fuck you!
So you see, you're never too young to die.
All right, so for my junk food pairing this week, I went with Pepsi Free. And there's a very specific reason for this. The popular soda brand Pepsi touted itself as the choice of a new generation, which was a slogan they christened in 1984, 2 years before this movie came out. Lance Stargrove was himself a new generation of James Bond, Never Too Young to Die being released in the wake, by the way. Here's something to keep in mind. This movie came out 1 year after one of the worst James Bond movies of all time, which was A View to a Kill. And in fact, I would argue, is a better James Bond film than A View to a Kill. So it being released in the wake of Roger Moore era of Bond ending, in 1982, Pepsi launched their Pepsi Free variety, which was celebrated as the first major brand caffeine-free cola in years. Turns out, folks didn't care for that, and like John Stamos as a caffeine-free James Bond, the window turned out to be very short for Pepsi Free, so Stargrove was a choice of the new generation, but not the choice of a new generation. So that's why I went with Pepsi Free as the junk food pairing. Now, if you want to kick it up a notch, maybe pour a little donkey sauce into that Pepsi Free, because without the advent of caffeine inside the soda, you may need a little extra boost. So if you're going to wax your goatee and pound a few, bro, maybe add a little donkey sauce to that Pepsi Free. But that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Please continue to follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. If you go to iTunes, please remember to rate and review us. Those reviews really do help. We appreciate that. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. And on facebook.com/massaworm.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or my page on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisbury. And again, if you have a few extra shekels to throw into the hat, we would really appreciate you becoming a patron. We do a lot of bonus episodes just for patrons. So hopefully we're giving back what you guys are throwing down. But I'm going to end this show just reminding you that you're never too young to die, and you're also always too old for donkey sauce.
Who knows what you'll find? You may like it or not, but all that's fine, boy, it's all that.